you. Thank you very much. Hello. How are you? You're all right. Good. Well, it's very nice to see you and a very warm welcome. I'm just going to start off by talking about myself for a minute or two. I come from a little village called Stanford in the Vale, which was in Berkshire, and then they juggled with the boundaries and now it's in Oxfordshire. But it was a very nice place to grow up. And I grew up there with my four older brothers and my sister Jean and my mum and dad. And when I think about it now, I don't want to try and sound like Laurie Lee, but when I think about it now, it was a very lovely childhood. I don't think you think about it at the time because you don't think things are going to change, do you? But it was, and I'm one of six, and our mother used to turn us out in the morning like a herd of cattle, really, and say, go on, clear off, I don't want to see you till dinner time, you know, and you'd all go off in a big gang, and you'd do nice things according to the seasons of the year, you know, so that we learned to swim. I learned to swim in the old river that goes through the middle of Stanford. And it's true that before we could get in to swim, we used to have to go in and drive the cattle out. You'd have to say, come on, girls, it's our turn now. And we had an old blown-up inner tube from a lorry tyre, you know, and we used to take it in turns to sit in it and paddle your way along the river. And it was so nice, you know, and when it was your turn to get the inner tube, it was just thrilling. You know, you couldn't have been happier if somebody had given you £1 million. Not that anybody was likely to. Anyway, and we used to do the things that all country kids did, and we used to go nutting at this time of the year. We used to go and get hazelnuts and chestnuts, and then we used to go mushrooming. I think mushrooming is a nice pursuit because mushrooms are sort of mysterious, aren't they? They come up overnight and then you never find them again in the same place for a decade. So we used to go mushrooming. But I think our favourite pastime of all was at haymaking time, when the farmer would make all the bales of hay and pile them up into big towers all neatly and tidily around the fields. And then in the evening, when we came out of school, we would go round to the field and rearrange them for them. We used to make these lovely bale houses in the fields where you'd put two bales along the sides and one across the end, and you'd build it up and you'd put a roof on it, and you'd have a single bale tunnel to get down to it, and you'd have to crawl along, and then you'd get into this bale sort of chamber, and it was so nice and dark and humid, and it used to smell sweetly of hay, and it was sort of a magical place, especially if you were in a big overcrowded home like we were, you know, to have a little room to yourself. It was lovely. But of course the older kids used to use it for more salacious purposes. And they used to go in and have a snog. And this caused great excitement because all the families were related to each other. And you'd go around to the field and somebody would say, "Here, Aunt Mary's in there with your Dennis having a snog." And somebody would do something romantic like tip a bucket of water in on top of it. Anyway, it was a good thing, really, that there was something salacious going on, because the teaching of the facts of life in Stanford in the Vale in the 50s at that time was very, very limited indeed. In fact, to the best of my recollection, the sex education I received consisted of my mother wagging her finger at me and saying, "Don't go bringing any trouble back here." I think that was the beginning and end of it, really. When I think about it now, it fills me with a mixture of sort of despair and mirth, because it was so stupid. You grew up, and nobody ever said, "Look, this is how things work," you know. And I don't know quite why that was, but nobody ever sat you down and said, "This is how things work." Instead, you were surrounded by all these threats and people wagging their fingers and these suggestions and warnings. And you were presented with a series of unassailable facts. So as you were growing up and becoming a teenager, you became aware of these unassailable facts. And the most important and crucial one was this: that men were only after one thing. You didn't know what it was, but they were after it, all right. And it was your solemn Christian duty to stop them from getting it. And this was by no means as easy as it might sound because, as my mother often told me, they would resort to subterfuge. And my mother used to say, they'll say anything. They'll say anything to get what they want. And so you'd grow up hearing all these warnings and having all these fingers wagged at you. And there were other ladies in the village who would also sort of add their little two penneth. There was a lady who had a big family. She had about 14 children, and she wasn't unusual because there were a lot of ladies with big families in the village. And I remember she said to me one day, and I never understood what she meant. She said, "Don't do what I did, Pammy." Get the ring on your finger first. And I never really understood what they were talking about. And the favourite saying of my mum, and I'm not at all criticising her because I know she was trying to protect me, so I'm not getting at her at all, but I think she thought I understood a lot more about life than I actually did. Because she used to say to me, "The woman has to carry the can." I didn't know what she was talking about. What can? You know what you're talking about. And so you grew up in absolute ignorance with all this sort of suggestion going on. And yet I used to read learned publications like The Valentine and The Roxy. And in them, you know, it all turned out all right. And Mr. Wright would appear and he would waft you down the aisle with you looking like a meringue. And you could go home and wait for all the bouncing babies to arrive. And then somehow it was all right. But luckily for me, something happened which taught me a great deal in a very short time. And this is true. I used to ride a pony in our village. We couldn't afford a pony of our own, of course, but there was a farm in the village where the girls had outgrown the pony, and I used to go and ride him. And I was about 10, I suppose, at the time. And on this particular day, I was going down to catch the pony, and I had the bridle and I had the apple to give him. And as I was walking along, I became aware of noises coming from the wall to my left, coming from the other side of the wall. There were all these grunts and gasps and puffing and blowing and strange noises. This is not going to be as bad as you think. And so, you know, I was curious. I went over and I looked over the wall and I had a look. And there, underneath the wall, tucked up under the wall, was a sow, a female pig. And she had separated herself from all the other pigs in the field and I suppose found herself what she thought was a little private place. And she was laying there and she was obviously in dire distress and discomfort because she was writhing and puffing and blowing and making these weird noises. And I was just about to rush off and get somebody to come and have a look at her, you know, to see what was wrong, when suddenly she took in an enormous intake of breath. She went like this and did an enormous push and all these piglets shot out the other end. This great line of wet piglets. And it wasn't disgusting. I mean, I wasn't disgusted. I was just amazed. And I can remember my jaw dropped. And that was the first inkling I had of how things work. You know, that something grew inside something else. And I remember looking at all these piglets as they made their way to the front and started to feed and everything. And thinking, oh, so that's where I came from. We all used to keep animals in Stamford in the Vale, particularly chickens. Everybody kept chickens at the bottom of the garden, and we were no exception because it was a place to put the scraps and you got nice fresh eggs. And my mum, for economy, used to get the chicks, the day-old chicks, and they used to come in a box on the train. They came in a grey box with holes along the side. And mother wouldn't tell us they were coming. And the first we would know that the chicks had arrived was that our mother would appear on the village green with her apron, with her wrap-over apron, and she'd call us in. She'd say, "Oi!" There was a lot of us. She couldn't remember our names. She'd say, "Oi! She'd say, come on in, I've got something to show you. Come and have a look, come on. And we'd all go stampeding into the kitchen. And there on the table would be a grey box with these holes along the side. And my mother would say one word. She'd say, Ark. Ark. And you'd put your ear down by this box and you could hear all the little chicks going, cheep, 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 cheep. And you'd know that the chicks had arrived. Yeah, and there'd be great excitement. And my mother would lift the lid off the box and there'd be this seething mass of little chicks. And you'd pick them up and stroke them and you'd jump up and down and erupt with excitement. Yeah, there wasn't much going on in Stamford and Bath. So you had to make the best of what there was. But, yeah, it was lovely. And the first poem I ever did on the radio, the first thing of mine that was ever broadcast, was a piece which concerned chickens. And I did it in the early 70s at BBC Radio Oxford. And I was very, very nervous, but excited. I was very excited because the idea of the BBC was so thrilling. And I went up the steps. And up until then, I'd only sort of performed things locally, but now it was going to be broadcast. And I did this poem, and then afterwards, like you do, I became sort of full of anxiety, and I came out and shuffled off down the pavement and thought, I wish I hadn't done that. You know, people are going to think I'm so stupid going in there spouting some old verse, you know, about a chicken. And I went away wishing I hadn't done it, and that people were going to think I was stupid. But anyway, after about a week, they broadcast this poem. And after about a week, I had a phone call from the BBC. I'll never forget, it was one of the great moments of my life. I had a phone call to say it had been chosen for Pick of the Week, you know, a roundup of all that was considered best on the radio that week. And so afterwards, I was really pleased, you know, I was glad that I'd had a go. So this is it then. This is the very first one I ever did on the radio, and it was very exciting for me because it made a big difference. Oh, I am a battery hen. On my back, there's not a germ. I've never scratched a farmyard, and I've never pecked a worm. I've never had the sunshine to warm me feathers through. Eggs I lay every day for the likes of you. Now, when you have them scrambled and piled up on your plate, it's me what you should thank for that. I never lays them late. I always lays them regular. I always lays them right. I never lays them brown. I always lays them white. But it's no life for a battery hen. In me box I'm sat. There's a funnel stuck out from the side. Me pellets comes down that. I gets a squirt of water every half a day, watching with me beady eye me eggs roll away. I lays them in a funnel, strategically placed, so that I can't kick them and let them go to waste. They rolls off down the tubing and up the gangway quick. And sometimes I get to thinking, that could have been a chick. Yeah, and I might have been a farmyard hen, scratching in the sun. There might have been a crowd of chicks after me to run. There might have been a cockerel fine to pay us his respects instead of sitting here till someone comes and wrings our necks. I see the time and motion clock is saying nearly noon. I expect me squirt of water will come flying at me soon. And then me spray of pellets will nearly break me leg. And I'll bite the wire netting and lay one more bloody egg. Thank you very much. I've not had a good week this week, you know, because I had to go to the dentist on Monday and have a wisdom tooth out. This is true. I'm not telling you a funny story. This is true. And I was very, very nervous. And I put it off for weeks and months, you know. And in the end, I thought, well, this is stupid. It's time to be brave and dignified, you know, and get in there and get on with it and come out the other side. It's no good keep putting it off. So anyway, I slunk in there, trying not to look at all the vile appurtenances of the dental trade. And I lay in the chair, sort of waiting for it all to happen, rigid with terror. And as I lay there, these immortal words came floating through the ether. Oh, I wish I'd looked after me teeth. Something really nice happened in connection with that poem, because the BBC, two or three years ago now, they did a survey to find the nation's most popular top 10 comic poems, and mine was voted into the top 10, that one. And I was really thrilled, and I was even more thrilled because when I looked down the list of poets in the top 10, I was one of the very few who's still alive. I've been doing this job for a long time now, and it's been a really lovely job. And I've, of course, met a lot of famous people from all different walks of life. But probably the first famous person I met was Diana Dors. And to be perfectly honest, it was a bit sort of an anticlimax, because I was asked very early on. I was on Opportunity Knocks in 1975, and I won, which was thrilling. And after I won Opportunity Knocks, one of the first exciting engagements I was asked to do was to appear at the London Palladium in a concert in aid of the Migraine Trust. And I was to go on and do a little bit, do a poem and crack a joke or something and get off. Well, anyway, I was thrilled to be on that famous stage. And before the show began, one of the organisers came round to me and said, now you must meet Miss Diana Dors, because she's here, she's taking part in the show as well, and she comes from near you, she comes from Swindon. So anyway, I got taken round there, and I was taken to this important door, and the organiser knocked on the door, and Diana Dors came to the door. And I must say, she looked stunning, but she looked like nobody I'd ever seen in Stamford in the Vale, if you know what I mean. Because she looked exceedingly curvaceous, and she had this amazing white sort of cottage loaf of a hairdo and these ferociously long dark eyelashes. And the person who'd taken me round said, this is Pam Ayres, Miss Dors. She's from your area and she's a poet. And it's one of those moments you always remember, because Diana looked me up and down a couple of times with no smile or anything, and she said, sweet. And that was it. That was it. I was dismissed from the present. And so I slunk away. But afterwards, I wished I hadn't gone, really. I've been married this year for 20 years. Yeah. Thank you very much. I find it amazing, really. It seems such a long time, doesn't it, 20 years? It sounds a long time. And I'm thrilled, really, because, to be perfectly honest, I didn't go into it with that much conviction. I thought I'd give it a try for a fortnight, see how I get on. No, but overall, it's worked out very, very well. My husband, he's a very nice man, he's a kind man, and under my guidance and tuition, I find he's... No, he's a very nice man, and he's a good dad and everything you'd want, really. The only thing is, I think with any couple, there are certain areas where you have to be a bit careful, because in that area you can flare up at each other more easily than in any other. And with us, we have one particular situation which it's difficult for us to avoid, because it involves travelling. And we travel a lot, with my job, and I'd hate to do a different job. So this situation where we tend to flare up at each other is when we're going somewhere we've never been before. My husband is driving the car, and I have been given the task. I didn't want it, but I've been given the task of reading the map. Now, honestly, when I was single, I was quite good at reading the map. I was quite good. I could sit down with the map, and I'd write down all the road numbers and the various destinations, and I'd put it on a postcard and stick it on a bit of blue tack on the dashboard, and as we went along, I'd just refer to it, and it was fine. I got on perfectly well. But years of abuse. Years of abuse and unfounded criticism, and being told I got the brain of a limpet. have sadly eroded not only my confidence, but they've also eroded my very ability to do it. And now I can't do it as well as I used to. I used to be good, but now I've sort of lost it. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. It's his fault. It's his fault because he never gives me enough notice of his requirements. No, seriously, if he was to say to me, if he was just to say, look, there's a difficult junction coming up, a very complicated intersection, if you'd like to look at the map, you know, brace yourself, that would be very helpful. But he doesn't do that, and I never know that he's lost until we're in the middle of some terrifyingly great roundabout, and we're going round and round the inside lane like that. And then I realise something's up, and he's saying something to me, but I can't understand what it is. Because he's talking to me through his teeth. And I say, what? And he says, which way is it? Which way is it? And I look at the map. And I look at him, and honestly, it's like sitting next to a radiator. No, you can feel the heat. You can feel the heat coming off him. And honestly, if you look closely, you can see the veins in his neck throbbing like this. And it's a very intimidatory situation. And I look at my map, and I'm frightened. I'm actually frightened of him. I look at the map, and I can see all the writing on it, but nothing is coming in. Nothing's coming. I haven't got a clue. I haven't got a clue. And he's saying, which way? Which way? And I have to say something. So I say, that one. And we go round the roundabout and we go down that road. And in a nanosecond, we've both realised two things. One is the wrong road. Secondly, that it's the longest road on the face of the earth. With nowhere to turn round. and a change has come over my husband. He's no longer raging and fuming. A terrible icy resignation has settled over him like a frost. And after the last joyful journey, I wrote my husband a short tribute, which I would like to include now. I am going to kill my husband. I have stuck all I can stick. His constant criticising is getting on my wick. He takes it all for granted. But tonight, I can relax. For the minute he complains, I shall whop him with the axe. Yes, I'm going to kill my husband. You may not think I've got the right, but he snores as well. And I should know I'm with him every night. With this irritating, steady rhythm. Whistle, snore, and snort. Well, tonight he's gonna stay asleep for longer than he thought. So that's that one. And the one which I've just finished is about a know-all. I think we all know somebody like this. And this piece is called They Should Have Asked My Husband. And it's nothing to do with my husband, of course. This world is complicated and imperfect and oppressed. And it's not hard to feel timid, apprehensive and depressed. It seems that all around us, tides of questions ebb and flow, and people want solutions, but they don't know where to go. Opinions abound, but who is wrong and who is right? People need a prophet, a diffuser of the light, someone they can turn to as the crises rage and swirl. Someone with the remedy, the wisdom, the pearl. Well, they should have asked my husband. He'd have told them then and there his thoughts on immigration, teenage mothers, Tony Blair, the future of the monarchy, house prices in the South, the wait for hip replacements, BSE and foot and mouth. Yes, they should have asked my husband. He can sort out any mess. He can rejuvenate the railways. He can cure the NHS. So any little niggle, anything you want to know, just run it past my husband, wind him up, and let him go. Congestion on the motorways, free holidays for thugs, the damage to the ozone layer, refugees, drugs. These may defeat the brain of any politician bloke, but present it to my husband and he'll solve it at a stroke. He'll clarify the situation. He will make it crystal clear. You'll feel the glazing of your eyeballs and the bending of your ear. Corruption at the top, he's an authority on that, and the Mafia, Gaddafi, and Yasser Arafat. Upon these areas, he brings his intellect to shine in a great, compelling voice that's twice as loud as yours or mine. I often wonder what it must be like to be so strong, infallible, articulate, self-confident, and wrong. When it comes to tolerance, he hasn't got a lot. Joyriders should be guillotined and muggers should be shot. The sound of his own voice becomes like music to his ears, and he hasn't got an inkling that he's boring us to tears. My friends don't call so often. They have busy lives, I know. And it's not every day you want to hear a windbag suck and blow. Encyclopedias. On them we never have to call. Why clutter up the bookshelf when my husband knows it all?